planning a long-prepared joint enterprise that must be met with a coordinated and firm response, an assumption that did not augur well for peace as the crisis entered its final phase. It is worth touching once again on the oddities of the Austro-Hungarian decision-making process. Berchtold, disparaged by many of the hawks in the administration as a soft touch, incapable of forming clear resolutions, took control of the policy debate after the 28th of June in a rather impressive way. But he could do this only through an arduous and time-consuming process of consensus building. The puzzling dissonances in the documents that track the emergence of the Austrian decision for war reflect the need to incorporate, without necessarily reconciling, opposed viewpoints. Perhaps the most striking defect of Austrian decision-making was the narrowness of the individual and collective fields of vision. The Austrians resembled hedgehogs scurrying across a highway with their eyes averted from the rushing traffic. The momentous possibility of a Russian general mobilization and the general European war that would inevitably follow was certainly glimpsed by the Austrian decision-makers, who discussed it on several occasions. But it was never integrated into the process by which options were weighed up and assessed. No sustained attention was given to the question of whether Austria-Hungary was in any position to wage a war with one or more other European great powers. There are several possible reasons for this. One was the extraordinary confidence of the Austro-Hungarian administration in the strength of German arms, which, it was believed, sufficed in the first instance to deter and, failing that, to defeat Russia. The second was that the hive-like structure of the Austro-Hungarian political elite was simply not conducive to the formulation of decisions through the careful sifting and balancing of contradictory information. The contributors to the debate tended to indulge in strong statements of opinion, often sharpened by mutual recriminations, rather than attempting to view the problems facing Vienna in the round. The solipsism of Austrian decision-making also reflected a profound sense of geopolitical isolation. The notion that Austro-Hungarian statesmen had a responsibility to Europe was nonsense, one political insider noted, because there is no Europe. Public opinion in Russia and France will always maintain that we are the guilty ones, even if the Serbs, in the midst of peace, invade us by the thousands one night, armed with bombs. But the most important reason for the perplexing narrowness of the Austrian policy debate is surely that the Austrians were so convinced of the rectitude of their case and of their proposed remedy against Serbia that they could conceive of no alternative to it. Even Tisa, after all, had accepted by the 7th of July that Belgrade was implicated in the crimes at Sarajevo and was willing, in principle, to countenance a military response, provided the timing and diplomatic context were right. Inaction would merely confirm the widely held conviction that this was an empire on its last legs. On the other hand, the moral effect of a bold action would be transformative. Austria-Hungary would again believe in itself. It would mean, I have the will, therefore I am. In short, the Austrians were in the process of making what decision theorists have called an opting decision, one in which the stakes are unimaginably high, the impact transformative and irrevocable, levels of emotion elevated, and the consequences of not acting potentially lasting. Decisions of this kind may acquire an existential dimension, in that they promise to reinvent the decision-making entity, to fashion it into something it was not before. At the core of such decisions is something rooted in identity that is not easily susceptible to rationalization. This is not to suggest that Austrian decision-making was irrational. The present crisis was assessed in the light of past developments, and various factors and risks were brought to bear on the discussion. Nor is it easy to see how the Austrians could make a less drastic solution work, given the reluctance of the Serbian authorities to meet Austrian expectations, the absence of any international legal bodies capable of arbitrating in such cases, and the impossibility in the current international climate of enforcing the future compliance of Belgrade. Yet at the core of the Austrian response, to an extent that does not apply to any of the other actors in 1914, was a temperamental, intuitive leap, a naked act of decision, founded in a shared understanding of what the Austro-Hungarian Empire was and must be, if it were to remain a great power. The strange death of Nikolai Hartwig. It was during the tranquilization phase of Austrian policy that the Russian minister in Belgrade suddenly died. Hartwig had been suffering from angina pectoris for some time. He was obese and prone to increasingly fierce headaches, the result not just of stress, but probably also of hypertension. It was his practice each summer to take the cure at Bad Nauheim, whence he would return with his spirits restored and his weight reduced. When his subordinate, Basil Strandmann, on hearing the news of the assassination, broke off his own vacation in Venice and returned to Belgrade, he found Hartwig in poor physical condition and longing to take his cure. The minister informed Strandmann that, as no important events could be expected before autumn, he had put in an application to take his vacation on the 13th of July. On the 10th of July, 3 days before he was due to leave, Hartwig learned that the Austrian minister Baron Giesel had just returned to Belgrade. He telephoned the Austrian legation and arranged a visit in order to clarify various misunderstandings. It was widely reported in Belgrade that on the 3rd of July, the day of the Archduke's requiem service, the Russian legation had been the only one in the Serbian capital not to fly its flag at half-mast. Both the Italian and the British mission chiefs in Belgrade had noticed the omission. On the evening following the assassinations, moreover, it was said that Hartwig had hosted a reception in his legation, from which cheering and laughter could be heard in the nearby streets. The Russian minister was probably also anxious, lest reports of other indiscretions had reached the ears of his Austrian colleague. In fact, the interview went quite amicably. Giesel cordially accepted Hartwig's explanations and excuses, and the two men settled down for a long talk in Giesel's office. Having spoken at some length of his poor health and his vacation plans, Hartwig came to the chief concern of his visit, a defense of Serbia's innocence of the murders and of its intentions for the future. But he had scarcely got through the first sentence when, at about 9:20 p.m., he lost consciousness and slowly slid, his cigarette still burning between his fingers, from the divan onto the carpet. Hartwig's carriage was sent at haste to collect his daughter Ludmilla, and a local Serbian doctor appeared, followed by Hartwig's physician, but despite the application of water, eau de cologne, ether, and ice, it proved impossible to bring him back to consciousness. Baroness Giesel's expressions of sympathy for Hartwig's daughter were brushed off with the comment that Austrian words were of no interest to her. Ludmilla von Hartwig, who had been spending the evening with Crown Prince Alexander of Serbia, made a point of inspecting the room in which her father had died, digging around in some large Japanese vases, sniffing at the bottle of eau de cologne that had been used to try to rouse him, and curtly inquiring whether her father had been given anything to eat or drink. Giesel replied that the minister had merely smoked a few Russian cigarettes that he had brought with him. The daughter asked for the butts and took them away in her purse. Neither the evidence of Hartwig's illness, of which he had made no secret, nor the assurances of the Austrian minister prevented assassination theories from circulating across the capital. One newspaper referred to Giesel and his wife as modern Borgias, who poisoned unwelcome guests, and a few days later Giesel himself overheard a conversation between two clients in his barber's shop. Austria sends us strange ambassadors. First we had an imbecile, Forgach, and now we have an assassin. Giesel has brought an electric chair from Vienna that causes the immediate death of anyone who sits down on it, and leaves not the slightest trace. Fortunately, neither of the two interlocutors recognized Giesel in the next chair. At the request of Hartwig's family and the Belgrade government, Sazonov gave permission for Hartwig to be buried in Serbia, a highly unusual procedure for a Russian diplomat who had died in foreign service. The expressions of public grief and the unprecedented pomp that accompanied his state funeral in Belgrade bore witness to the extraordinary place he occupied in Serbian public awareness. However one assesses Hartvig's contribution to Balkan politics, it would be churlish to deny that the Russian minister had already achieved his primary objectives when he collapsed on Giesel's divan. In the words of the French envoy Decaux, Hartvig died at the very moment when his indomitable will had triumphed by imposing on Serbism his absolute authority, and on Europe the Serbian question in the violent form dear to his heart. 9. The French in St. Petersburg. Count de Robien changes trains. On the 6th of July 1914, the 26-year-old French diplomat, Louis de Robien, left Paris for St. Petersburg, where he had been appointed attaché at the French embassy. The date of his departure had been pulled forward so that he would arrive in good time to help with the preparations for the state visit by President Poincaré, which was scheduled for the 20th of July. To gain time, de Robien did not take the Nord Express, which did not leave every day, but boarded an ordinary sleeping car in the fast train to Cologne. There was time to look briefly at the Rhine and the great Gothic cathedral before the connecting train crossed the industrial region of the Ruhr, always so impressive and not without a certain beauty. From there the train made its way eastwards, traversing Germany at its widest point, until it reached Virbalen, today the Lithuanian town of Kybate, on the eastern border of East Prussia. Here, much to his annoyance, de Robien had to leave his comfortable German sleeping car and change trains because of the difference between the Russian and European gauges. His first encounter with the locals on the far side of the border made a lasting impression. As soon as the train had stopped, the carriages were invaded by a horde of bearded persons wearing boots and white aprons who took charge of his baggage with such haste that he was unable to follow them. De Robien and his fellow passengers were channeled towards a barricade, before which stood soldiers with great sabres. Here their passports were verified, a procedure that astonished de Robien, because in that era of liberty one travelled everywhere in Europe except for Russia without carrying a passport. After presenting his travel documents, de Robien waited in a vast room in whose corners were icons, lit by stands of burning candles, a strange accoutrement, he felt, for what was effectively a waiting room. At last the formalities were complete, and the train passed through a countryside of terrible sadness, studded with villages over which loomed the onion domes of churches. He tried to speak with some officers, who appeared to be engineers, but they spoke only a few words of German. "We felt," he recalled, "as if we were in China." His arrival in St. Petersburg, where he would spend the war years and live through the cataclysm of two revolutions, did nothing to dispel the sense of strangeness. On the contrary, it merely completed our disappointment. The Russian capital was full of horrible little carriages, long, poorly maintained roads, and bearded, exotic-looking coachmen. He initially booked in at the Hotel France, where the rooms were large but the furniture so ugly and the ambiance so comfortless and different from what we were used to in Europe, that he decided to cancel his reservation and move instead to the Hotel d'Europe on the famous Nevsky Prospect. But even the Hotel d'Europe was not especially European, and the shops along the great Riverside Avenue were disappointing. The best of them, the Parisian nobleman wrote, were reminiscent of a French provincial town. Getting about was difficult, because scarcely any passers-by could understand him, which was a shock, since his colleagues in Paris had assured him that the French language would be familiar to everybody. The food and drink of the city brought little comfort to the fastidious count. Russian cuisine, he reported, was awful, especially the fish soups, which were detestable. Only borscht struck him as a recipe worth keeping on the menu. As for their vodka, drunk at one draught, it was unworthy of a civilized palate educated to the slow enjoyment of our cognacs, our armagnacs, our marks, and our kirsch. Having found his bearings in the city, de Robien made his way to his new place of work. There was some consolation in the fact that the French embassy, housed in a fine palace that had belonged to the Dolgarouki family, was situated at one of the most beautiful points along the banks of the Neva. De Robien was especially impressed by the footmen in their blue livery and short breeches. On the ground floor, looking out over the river, could be found the ambassador's office, decorated with tapestries and paintings by Van der Meulen. Next door was a smaller room where the telephone was kept. It was here that the embassy staff gathered each afternoon for the ritual taking of tea. Next to this room was the office of the councillor, Monsieur Dulce, whose walls were decorated with portraits of all the ambassadors of France to the court of Russia. At the back, behind an office crowded with secretaries and archival files, was a door opening onto the embassy strongroom, where secret documents and the transmissions code were stored. The pride of the embassy was the reception room on the first floor, a fine boudoir with walls of green and gold damask hung with paintings by Guardi belonging to the ambassador, and gilt armchairs that were supposed to have furnished the rooms of Marie Antoinette. De Robien already knew Ambassador Maurice Paléologue, a larger-than-life figure who had been in post since January and would dominate the life of the embassy until his departure 3 years later. Photographs from 1914 show a dapper man of medium height with a shaven head and very brilliant eyes deeply lodged within their sockets. Paléologue was a romancer rather than a diplomat, De Robien recalled. He viewed all events from their dramatic and literary angle. Whenever he recounted an event or sought to retrace a conversation, he recreated them almost entirely in his imagination, endowing them with more vividness than truth. Paléologue was extremely proud of his name, which he claimed, speciously, to have inherited from the emperors of ancient Byzantium. He compensated for his exotic ancestry. His father was a Greek political refugee and his mother a Belgian musician, with a passionate and demonstrative patriotism and a desire to project himself as the embodiment of French refinement and cultural superiority. Once installed in St. Petersburg, Paléologue, who had never held such a senior post before, soon filled out the dimensions of his new office. De Robien observed the ways in which the ambassador would make his importance felt to the representatives of lesser countries. When the secretary announced the arrival of the Belgian envoy Buisseret or his Dutch colleague Swerts, it was Paléologue's habit to go out by the back door for a walk, in order to greet them in the anteroom an hour later with arms opened, saying, "My dear fellow, I've had so much on today." He displayed a taste for extravagance and ostentation that was exceptional, even in the world of the senior ambassadors. Much was made in St. Petersburg society of the fact that embassy dinners were prepared by the chef Paléologue had brought with him from Paris. De Robien put all this down to Paléologue's Oriental ancestry, adding archly that, as with many parvenus, Paléologue's love of magnificence had something affected and unnatural about it. Paléologue had a horror of the kind of detailed dispatches that were the bread and butter of workaday diplomacy, preferring to shape his impressions into lively scenes invigorated by dialogues in which catchy phrases replaced the long and often ambiguous verbal circumlocutions that were the day-to-day traffic of diplomats working in Russia. De Robien recalled one particular day on which the ambassador was scheduled to be received in audience by the Tsar for a conversation on an important military matter. Paléologue wished the dispatch to be sent as soon as he returned to the embassy, so that it would reach Paris at the time when it would have the greatest effect. In order to achieve this, he composed the account of his meeting before he had even left the embassy to see the Russian sovereign. De Robien and his colleagues got busy encoding the detailed narrative of a conversation that had never taken place. Amid all the faux reportage, the Count remembered one highly characteristic Paléologian phrase. "At this point, the interview reached a crucial turning point, and the Emperor offered me a cigarette." De Robien's comments on the ambassador, though hostile, were probably fair. Paléologue was one of the most iridescent personalities to hold ambassadorial office in the French service. For many years, he had languished in the Parisian Centrale, condemned to tedious copying tasks. Later, he was placed in charge of keeping the secret files, especially those relating to the Franco-Russian alliance and liaison between Foreign Ministry and Army Intelligence Services, work that he relished. His long years as the custodian of the Ministry's accumulated understanding of the alliance and of the military threats facing it, he had access, for example, to French intelligence on Germany's two-pronged mobilization plan, imbued him with a view of French foreign relations that was tightly focused on the German threat and the paramount importance of Allied cohesion. His historical writings convey a romantic conception of the great man as one who gives himself to moments of world historical decision. In certain cases, Paleologue wrote in his biography of Count Cavour, the wise man leaves much to chance. Reason prompts him to follow blindly after impulses or instincts beyond reason that seem to be heaven-sent. No man can say when these should be dead or when deserted. Nor book, nor rules, nor experience can teach him. A certain sense and a certain daring alone can inform him. Paleologue's pronounced and unwavering Germanophobia was coupled with a taste for catastrophic scenarios that many colleagues recognized as dangerous. During his stint in Sofia, 1907-12, one of the few foreign posts he held before accepting the mission to St. Petersburg, a colleague there reported that Paleologue's dispatches and conversation alike were full of wild talk of horizons, of clouds and menacing storms. Indeed, it is hard to find any contemporary comment on the future ambassador that unequivocally praises him. There were simply too many bad reports, one senior Foreign Office functionary observed in May 1914, for there to be any question of confidence in the new ambassador. Izvolsky characterized him as a phrase-maker, a fantasist, and very smooth. Even his British colleagues in Sofia described Paleologue in 1912 as excitable, inclined to spread sensational and alarmist rumors, and a trafficker in tall tales. Paleologue's appointment to the St. Petersburg Embassy, the most strategically sensitive and important posting in French diplomacy, might thus seem rather remarkable. He owed his rise through the service more to the prevalent political alignment than to the usual array of professional qualifications. Delcasse discovered Paleologue and energetically promoted him, mainly because they shared the same views on the German threat to France. In Paleologue, Delcasse found a subordinate who could echo and reinforce his own ideas. Paleologue's star waned after Delcasse's fall in 1905, and he wound up making do with various minor posts. It was Poincaré who rescued him. The two men had been intimate since the days when they were both pupils at the Lycée Louis-le-Grand in Paris. Paleologue's great gift, de Robien unkindly remarked, consisted in having been one of Poincaré's and Millerand's classmates at high school. It was to their friendship that he owed his astonishing career. As Prime Minister, Poincaré recalled Paleologue from Sofia in 1912 and appointed him political director at the Quai. This dramatic promotion, an amazing leap in seniority for such a quirky and controversial man, shocked many of the veteran ambassadors. The French ambassador to Madrid commented to Bertie that Paleologue was not of the right stuff for the directorship, while the French ambassador to Japan described him as a lamentable choice. These were strong words, even by the standards of the diplomatic service, where the upwardly mobile often attract envious sniping. "We must hope," Herr Crow noted in London, "that the atmosphere of Paris will have a sedative effect on Monsieur Paleologue, but this is not usually the effect of Paris." Poincaré was aware of Paleologue's reputation and did what he could to curb his excesses, but the two friends entered into a close working relationship, based on a profound agreement on all key questions. Poincaré came to depend on Paleologue's judgment. Indeed, it was Paleologue who encouraged Poincaré to commit France more firmly in the Balkans. Paleologue did not believe that a reconciliation between Austrian and Russian interests in the region would be possible, and his obsession with the nefarious designs of Berlin and Vienna made him blind to the machinations of Russian policy. He saw in the two Balkan wars an opportunity for Russia to consolidate its position on the peninsula. The close link with Poincaré was one reason why Sazonov, although he knew of Paleolog's idiosyncrasies, welcomed the new ambassador's appointment to St. Petersburg. Here was a man who could be trusted to take up in January 1914, where Delcasse had left off. In a conversation with a Russian diplomat who happened to be passing through Paris, Paleolog declared on the eve of his departure that he was taking the St. Petersburg post so that he could put an end to the policy of concessions that had hitherto prevailed, and that he would fight for a future hard-line policy without compromise or vacillation. Enough of all this. We should show Germany our strength. These were the convictions, attitudes, and relationships that would guide the new ambassador during the summer crisis of 1914. Monsieur Poincaré sails to Russia. At 11:30 p.m. on the Wednesday, the 15th of July, the presidential train left the Gare du Nord in Paris for Dunkirk. On board were Raymond Poincaré, the new Prime Minister, René Viviani, and Paleolog's successor as political director at the Quai d'Orsay, Pierre de Margerie. Early the following morning, the three men joined the battleship France for the journey through the Baltic to Kronstadt and St. Petersburg. Viviani was new in post. The former socialist had been prime minister for only 4 weeks and had no experience or knowledge whatsoever of external affairs. His principal utility to Poincaré consisted in the fact that he had recently converted to the cause of the three-year law, commanded a sizable following in the chamber, and was prepared to support Poincaré's views on defence. As the state visit to Russia unfolded, it would quickly become apparent that he was politically out of his depth. Pierre de Margerie, by contrast, was an experienced career diplomat who had been brought to Paris by Poincaré in the spring of 1912, at the age of 51, to occupy the post of associate director at the Quai d'Orsay. Poincaré had created this watchdog post in the hope that de Margerie would keep an eye on Paleolog and check any major indiscretions. As it happened, this proved unnecessary. Paleolog performed to Poincaré's satisfaction, and when his reward came in the form of the posting to St. Petersburg, de Margerie succeeded to the political directorship. In this role, he proved himself efficient and, most importantly of all in the president's eyes, politically loyal. Neither Viviani nor de Margerie was capable of mounting an effective challenge to the president's control over policy. Poincaré had much to think about as he boarded the France at Dunkirk at 5 a.m. on the 16th of July. First, there was Charles Humbert's sensational indictment of the French military administration. In a speech before the Senate of the 13th of July, to mark the submission of his report on the special budgetary vote for army materiel, Humbert, senator for the Meuse, a department on the border with Belgium, had delivered a swinging attack on the French military administration. French forts, he claimed, were of poor quality. Fortress guns lacked ammunition, and the wireless installations for fort-to-fort communications were faulty. Whenever the German wireless installation at Metz was transmitting, Humbert claimed, the station at Verdun went on the blink. French artillery was quantitatively inferior to the German, especially in heavy guns. One detail above all caught the attention of the French public, and particularly of the nation's mothers. The army was woefully short of boots. If war broke out, Humbert declared, French soldiers would have to take to the field with only one pair of boots, plus a single 30-year-old reserve boot in their knapsacks. The speech triggered a political sensation. In his reply, Minister of War Adolf Messimy did not deny the substance of the charges, but insisted that rapid progress was being made on all fronts. The deficiencies in artillery provision would be made good by 1917. This was all the more annoying for the fact that the man at the forefront of the resulting parliamentary agitation was Poincaré's old enemy Georges Clemenceau, who was claiming that the incompetence revealed in the report justified withholding parliamentary support for the new military budget. It had only just been possible to resolve the issue and pass the new military budget in time to avoid a postponement of the president's departure. On the day they left for Dunkirk, Viviani seemed nervous and preoccupied by the thought of intrigues and conspiracies, despite Poincaré's efforts to calm him. As if this were not enough, Madame Caillou's trial was due to open on the 20th of July, and there was reason to fear that exposures and revelations in court might trigger a chain of scandals that would shake the government. The scope of the threat became apparent when rumours circulated that the murdered newspaper editor Calmette had also had in his possession deciphered German telegrams revealing the extent of Caillou's negotiations with Germany during the Agadir crisis in 1911. In these communications, according to the telegrams at least, Caillou had spoken of the desirability of a rapprochement with Berlin. Caillou also claimed to possess affidavits, proving that Poincaré had orchestrated the campaign against him. On the 11th of July, 3 days before the president's departure for Russia, Caillou threatened to make these known to the public if Poincaré did not press for the acquittal of his wife. The occult machines of Parisian political intrigue were still turning at full throttle. Despite these concerns, Poincaré embarked on his journey across the Baltic Sea in a surprisingly calm and resolved mood. It must have been a huge relief to escape Paris at a time when the Caillou trial had thrown the newspapers into a frenzy. He spent much of the first 3 days of the crossing on the deck of the France briefing Viviani, whose ignorance of foreign policy he found shocking, for the mission in St. Petersburg. His summary of these tutorials, which gives us a clear sense of Poincaré's own thinking as he left Paris, included details on the alliance, an overview of the various subjects raised in St. Petersburg in 1912, the military conventions of France and Russia, Russia's approach to England regarding a naval convention, and relations with Germany. "I have never had difficulties with Germany," Poincaré declared, "because I have always treated her with great firmness." The subjects raised in St. Petersburg in 1912 included the reinforcement of strategic railways, the importance of massive offensive strikes from the Polish salient, and the need to focus on Germany as the principal adversary. And the reference to England is an indication that Poincaré was thinking in terms not just of the alliance with Russia, but of the embryonic Triple Entente. Here, in a nutshell, was Poincaré's security credo. "The alliance is our bedrock. It is the indispensable key to our military defense. It can only be maintained by intransigence in the face of demands from the opposing bloc." These were the axioms that would frame his interpretation of the crisis unfolding in the Balkans. To judge from the diary entries, Poincaré found the days at sea profoundly relaxing. While Viviani fretted over the news of Parisian scandal and intrigue arriving in fragments via the radio telegraph from Paris, Poincaré enjoyed the warm air on deck and the play of the sunshine on a blue sea brushed by imperceptible waves. There was just one small hitch. While approaching the harbour at Kronstadt, the France, steaming along at 15 knots in the early morning darkness of the 20th of July, managed to ram a Russian tugboat towing a frigate towards its berth. The incident woke Poincaré in his cabin. How vexing that a French warship sailing in neutral waters under the command of an admiral of the fleet should have struck and damaged a tugboat of the Allied nation. It was, he noted irritably in the diary, a gesture lacking in dexterity and elegance. The president's good cheer was restored by the brilliant scene that greeted the France as it sailed into Kronstadt harbour. From all directions, naval vessels and festively decorated packet and pleasure boats motored out to welcome the visitors, and the imperial launch pulled alongside to transfer Poincaré to the Tsar's yacht Alexandria. "I leave the France," Poincaré noted, "with the emotion that always overcomes me when, to the noise of cannon fire, I leave one of our warships." Across the water, standing beside the Tsar on the bridge of the Alexandria, where he had an excellent view of the entire scene, Maurice Paleologue was already mentally composing a paragraph for his memoirs. It was a magnificent spectacle. In a quivering, silvery light, the France slowly surged forward over the turquoise and emerald waves, leaving a long white furrow behind her. Then she stopped majestically. The mighty warship which has brought the head of the French state is well worthy of her name. She was indeed France coming to Russia. I felt my heart beating. The Poker Game. The minutes of the summit meetings that took place over the next 3 days have not survived. In the 1930s, the editors of the Document Diplomatique Français searched for them in vain. And the Russian records of the meetings, less surprisingly perhaps, given the disruptions to archival continuity during the years of war and civil war, have also been lost. Nevertheless, it is possible by reading the accounts in Poincaré's diaries, alongside the memoirs of Paléologue and the notes kept by other diplomats present during those fateful days, to get a fairly clear sense of what transpired. The meetings were centrally concerned with the crisis unfolding in Central Europe. It is important to emphasize this, because it has often been suggested that as this was a long-planned state visit, rather than an exercise in crisis summitry, the matters discussed must have followed a pre-planned agenda, in which the Serbian question occupied a subordinate place. In fact, quite the opposite is the case. Even before Poincaré had left the France, the Tsar was already telling the ambassador how much he was looking forward to his meeting with the President of the Republic. "We shall have weighty matters to discuss. I am sure we shall agree on all points. But there is one question which is very much in my mind, our understanding with England. We must get her to come into our alliance." As soon as the formalities were done with, the Tsar and his guest made their way to the stern of the Alexandria and entered into conversation. "Or perhaps I should say a discussion," wrote Paléologue, "for it was obvious that they were talking business, firing questions at each other and arguing." It seemed to the ambassador that Poincaré was dominating the conversation. Soon he was doing all the talking, while the Tsar simply nodded acquiescence, but the Tsar's whole appearance showed his sincere approval. According to Poincaré's diary, the conversation in the yacht touched first on the alliance, of which the Tsar spoke with great firmness. The Tsar asked him about the Humbert scandal, which he said had made a very bad impression in Russia, and he urged Poincaré to do whatever was necessary to prevent the 3-year law from falling. Poincaré in turn assured him that the new French chamber had shown its true will by voting to retain the law, and that Viviani too was a firm supporter. Then the Tsar raised the matter of the relations between Sergei Vita and Joseph Caillou, who were said to be the exponents of a new foreign policy based on rapprochement between Russia, France, Germany, and Britain. But the two men agreed that this was an unfeasible project that posed no threat to the current geopolitical alignment. In short, even as they made their way to shore, Poincaré and the Tsar established that they were both thinking along the same lines. The key point was alliance solidarity, and that meant not just diplomatic support, but the readiness for military action. On the second day, the 21st of July, the Tsar came to see Poincaré in his apartments at the Peterhof, and the two men spent an hour tête-à-tête. This time, the conversation focused first on the tension between Russia and Britain in Persia. Poincaré adopted a conciliating tone, insisting that these were minor vexations that ought not to compromise good Anglo-Russian relations. Both men agreed that the source of the problem did not lie in London or St. Petersburg, but with unspecified local interests of no broader relevance. And the Tsar noted with some relief that Edward Grey had not allowed Berlin's discovery of the naval talks to scupper the search for a convention. Some other issues were touched on: Albania, Greco-Turkish tension over the Aegean Islands, and Italian policy. But the Tsar's most vivid preoccupation, Poincaré noted, related to Austria and to her plans in the aftermath of the events at Sarajevo. At this point in the discussion, Poincaré reported, the Tsar made a highly revealing comment. "He repeats to me that under the present circumstances, the complete alliance between our two governments appears to him more necessary than ever." Nicholas left soon afterwards. Here again, the central theme was the unshakable solidarity of the Franco-Russian alliance in the face of possible provocations from Austria. But what did this mean in practice? Did it mean that the alliance would respond to an Austrian démarche against Serbia with a war that must, by necessity, be continental in scope? Poincaré offered a coded answer to this question on that afternoon, the 21st of July, when, together with Viviani and Paleologue, he received the various ambassadors. The second in line was the Austro-Hungarian ambassador, Fritz Zappari, newly returned from Vienna, where he had been at the bedside of his dying wife. After a few words of sympathy on the assassination, Poincaré asked whether there had been any news of Serbia. "The judicial inquiry is proceeding," Zappari answered. Paleologue's account of Poincaré's reply accords closely with that given in Zappari's dispatch. "Of course I am anxious about the result of this inquiry, Monsieur l'Ambassadeur. I can remember two previous inquiries which did not improve your relations with Serbia. Don't you remember? The Friedung affair and the Prochaska affair?" This was an extraordinary response for a head of state visiting a foreign capital to make to the representative of a third state. Quite apart from the taunting tone, it was, in effect, denying in advance the credibility of any findings the Austrians might produce in their inquiry into the background of the assassinations. It amounted to declaring that France did not, and would not, accept that the Serbian government bore any responsibility whatsoever for the murders in Sarajevo, and that any demands made upon Belgrade would be illegitimate. The Friedung and Prochaska affairs were pretexts for an a priori rejection of the Austrian grievance. In case this was not clear enough, Poincaré went on, "I remark to the ambassador with great firmness that Serbia has friends in Europe who would be astonished by an action of this kind." Paleologue remembered an even sharper formulation. "Serbia has some very warm friends in the Russian people, and Russia has an ally, France. There are plenty of complications to be feared." Zappari, too, reported the president as saying that an Austrian action would produce a situation dangerous for peace. Whatever Sazonov's exact words, the effect was shocking, and not just for Zappari, but even for the Russians standing nearby, some of whom, de Robien reported, were known for their antipathy towards Austria. At the close of his dispatch, Zappari noted, and it is hard to fault his judgment, that the tactless, almost threatening demeanour of the French president, a foreign statesman who was a guest in this country, stood in conspicuous contrast with the reserved and cautious attitude of Mr. Sazonov. The whole scene suggested that the arrival of Poincaré in St. Petersburg would have anything but a calming effect. In commenting on the contrast between Sazonov and Poincaré, Zappari identified a raw nerve in the Franco-Russian relationship. During an embassy dinner that evening, a splendid affair in honour of the president, Poincaré sat next to Sazonov. In stifling heat, the room was poorly ventilated, they discussed the Austro-Serbian situation. To his dismay, Poincaré found Sazonov preoccupied and little disposed to firmness. "The timing is bad for us," Sazonov said. "Our peasants are still very busy with their work in the fields." In the meanwhile, in the petit salon next door, where the less important guests were being entertained, a different mood prevailed. Here, a colonel from Poincaré's entourage was heard proposing a toast, "To the next war and to certain victory." Poincaré was unsettled by Sazonov's irresolution. "We must," he told Paleologue, "warn Sazonov of the evil designs of Austria, encourage him to remain firm and promise him our support." Later that night, after a reception by the municipal assembly, Poincaré found himself sitting at the back of the imperial yacht with Vivani and Izvolsky, who had travelled back from Paris to take part in the meetings. Izvolsky seemed preoccupied. Perhaps he had been talking with Sazonov. Viviani appeared sad and surly. As the yacht sailed along towards the Peterhof in virtual silence, Poincaré looked up into the night sky and asked himself, "What does Austria have in store for us?" The next day, the 22nd of July, was particularly difficult. Viviani appeared to be having a breakdown. It came to a head in the afternoon when the French Prime Minister, who happened to be seated at lunch to the left of the Tsar, seemed to find it impossible to answer any of the questions addressed to him. By mid-afternoon, his behaviour had become more outlandish. While Nicholas and Poincaré sat listening to a military band, Viviani was seen standing alone near the imperial tent, muttering, grumbling, swearing loudly, and generally drawing attention to himself. Paleologue's efforts to calm him were of no avail. Poincaré's diary registered the situation with a lapidary comment. "Viviani is getting sadder and sadder, and everyone is starting to notice it. The dinner is excellent." Eventually, it was announced that Viviani was suffering from a liver crisis and would have to retire early. Why the Prime Minister was feeling so poorly is impossible to establish with certainty. His collapse may well, as some historians have suggested, have been precipitated by his anxieties about developments in Paris. A telegram had arrived on Wednesday reporting that Caillou had threatened to expose various sensitive transcripts in court. But it is more likely that Viviani, a deeply pacific man, was alarmed by the steadily intensifying mood of belligerence at the various Franco-Russian gatherings. This is certainly what de Robien thought. It was clear to the French attaché that Viviani was overwrought by all these expressions of the military spirit. On the 22nd of July, de Robien noted, the talk was of nothing but war. One felt that the atmosphere had changed since the night before. He laughed when the Marines who crewed the France told him that they were worried about the prospect of coming under attack on the home crossing, but their nervousness was an ominous sign. The high point was Thursday the 23rd of July, Poincaré's last day in Russia, when the heads of state witnessed a military review involving 70,000 men against a backdrop of military music consisting mainly of the Sombre et Meuse and the Marche Lorraine, which the Russians appeared to consider the personal hymn of Poincaré. Particularly striking was the fact that the troops were not wearing their elaborate ceremonial uniforms, but the khaki battle dress they had worn for training. De Robien interpreted this as yet another symptom of a general eagerness for war. Poincaré and Paleologue witnessed one of the most curious expressions of alliance solidarity on the evening of the 22nd of July, when Grand Duke Nikolai Nikolaevich, commander of the Imperial Guard, gave a dinner for the guests at Krasnaya Sela, a recreational suburb of St. Petersburg with many handsome villas, including the summer residences of the Tsars. The scene was picturesque. Three long tables were set in half-open tents around a freshly watered garden bursting with fragrant blooms. When the French ambassador arrived, he was greeted by Grand Duke Nikolai's wife, Anastasia, and her sister Militsa, who was married to Nikolai's brother, Pyotr Nikolaevich. The two sisters were daughters of the remarkably energetic and ambitious King Nikola of Montenegro. "Do you realize," they said, both talking at once, "that we are passing through historic days? At the review tomorrow, the bands will play nothing but the Marche Lorraine and Sombre et Meuse. I've had a telegram, in prearranged code, from my father today. He tells me we shall have war before the end of the month. What a hero my father is! He's worthy of the Iliad. Just look at this little box I always take about with me. It's got some Lorraine soil in it, real Lorraine soil I picked up over the frontier when I was in France with my husband 2 years ago. Look there, at the table of honour. It's covered with thistles. I didn't want to have any other flowers there. They're Lorraine thistles, don't you see? I gathered several plants on the annexed territory, brought them here, and had the seeds sown in my garden. Militsa, go on talking to the ambassador. Tell him all today means to us while I go and receive the Tsar." Militsa was not speaking figuratively. A letter of November 1912 from the French military attaché in St. Petersburg, General Laguiche, confirms that in the summer of that year, while her husband was attending the French manoeuvres near Nancy, the Grand Duchess had sent someone over the border into German-controlled Lorraine with instructions to collect a thistle and some soil. She brought the thistle back to Russia, cared for it until it germinated, then planted the seeds in the Lorraine earth, watered it carefully until new thistles grew, then mixed the Lorraine soil with Russian soil to symbolize the Franco-Russian alliance and passed it to her gardener for propagation, with the warning that if the thistles died, he would lose his job. It was from this garden that she harvested the samples she showed to Poincaré in July 1914. These extravagant gestures had real political import. Anastasia's husband, Grand Duke Nikolai, a Pan-Slavist and the first cousin once removed of the Tsar, was among those most active in pressing Nicholas II to intervene militarily on Serbia's behalf, should Austria press Belgrade with unacceptable demands. The Montenegrin rhapsody continued during dinner, as Anastasia regaled her neighbours with prophecies. "There's going to be a war. There'll be nothing left of Austria. You're going to get back Alsace and Lorraine. Our armies will meet in Berlin. Germany will be destroyed," and so on. Poincaré, too, saw the princesses in action. He was sitting next to Sazonov during an entr'acte in the ballet when Anastasia and Militsa approached and began upbraiding the foreign minister for insufficient ardour in Serbia's support. Once again, the limpness of the foreign minister's manner gave pause for thought, but Poincaré noted with satisfaction that the Tsar, for his part, without being quite as ecstatic as the two grand duchesses, seems to me more determined than Sazonov to defend Serbia diplomatically. These dissonances did not prevent the alliance partners from agreeing on a common course of action. At 6 p.m. on the 23rd of July, the evening of the departure of the French, Viviani, who seemed somewhat recovered from his attack of liver, agreed with Sazonov the instructions to be sent to the Russian and French ambassadors in Vienna. The ambassadors were to mount a friendly joint démarche, recommending moderation to Austria, and expressing the hope that she should do nothing that could compromise the honour or the independence of Serbia. These words were, of course, carefully chosen to interdict in advance the note that both parties already knew the Austrians were about to present. George Buchanan agreed to suggest that his own government send an analogous message. That evening, during the pre-departure dinner held on the deck of the France, there was a highly emblematic dispute between Viviani and Paleolog over the wording of a communique to be drawn up for the press. Paleolog's draft ended by alluding to Serbia with the words, "The two governments have discovered that their views and intentions for the maintenance of the European balance of power, especially in the Balkan Peninsula, are absolutely identical." Viviani was unhappy with this formulation. "I think it involves us a little too much in Russia's Balkan policy," he said. Another, more anodyne draft was drawn up. The visit which the President of the Republic has just paid to HM, the Emperor of Russia, has given the two friendly and allied governments an opportunity of discovering that they are in entire agreement in their views on the various problems which concern for peace and the balance of power in Europe has laid before the powers, especially in the Balkans. This was a fine exercise in the art of euphemism. Yet, despite its prudent tone, the revised communique was easily decoded and exploited by the liberal and pan-Slav Russian papers, which began pushing openly for military intervention in support of Belgrade. Poincaré was not especially happy with how the dinner had gone. The heavy afternoon rain had virtually torn down the marquee on the aft deck, where the guests were supposed to be sitting, and the ship's cook did not cover himself in glory. The soup course was late, and no one praised the dishes, Poincaré later noted. But the president could afford to be satisfied with the overall impact of the visit. He had come to preach the gospel of firmness, and his words had fallen on ready ears. Firmness in this context meant an intransigent opposition to any Austrian measure against Serbia. At no point do the sources suggest that Poincaré or his Russian interlocutors gave any thought whatsoever to what measures Austria-Hungary might legitimately be entitled to take in the aftermath of the assassinations. There was no need for improvisations or new policy statements. Poincaré was simply holding fast to the course he had plotted since the summer of 1912. This may help explain why, in contrast to many of those around him, he remained so conspicuously calm throughout the visit. This was the Balkan inception scenario envisaged in so many Franco-Russian conversations. provided the Russians, too, stayed firm, everything would unfold as the policy had foreseen. Poincaré called this a policy for peace, because he imagined that Germany and Austria might well back down in the face of such unflinching solidarity. But if all else failed, there were worse things than a war at the side of mighty Russia and, one hoped, the military, naval, commercial, and industrial power of Great Britain. De Robien, who observed all this from close quarters, was not impressed. Poincaré, he felt, had deliberately overridden the authority of Viviani, who, as Premier and Minister of Foreign Affairs, was the responsible office-holder, pressing assurances and promises upon Nicholas II. Just before they separated, Poincaré reminded the Tsar, "This time we must hold firm." At almost exactly the same moment, de Robien recalled, the Austrian ultimatum was presented to Belgrade. Our opponents, too, had decided to hold firm. On both sides, they imagined that bluffing would suffice to achieve success. None of the players thought that it would be necessary to go all the way. The tragic poker game had begun. It was in the nature of great men, Paleolog would later write, to play such fateful games. The man of action, he observed in his study of Cavour, becomes a gambler, for each grave action implies not only an anticipation of the future, but a claim to be able to decide events, to lead and control them. 10. The ultimatum. Austria demands. While Poincaré and Viviani were steaming towards the harbour at Kronstadt, the Austrians put the final touches to the ultimatum to be presented in Belgrade. Travelling in unmarked vehicles to avoid notice, the members of the Joint Ministerial Council made their way to Berchtold's private apartments on Sunday, the 19th of July, for a meeting to resolve the forthcoming diplomatic action against Serbia. There was an informal discussion about the note to be sent to Belgrade, and the text was definitively settled. It was agreed that the ultimatum would be presented at 5 p.m. on the 23rd of July, subsequently postponed to 6 p.m. to ensure that it would arrive after Poincaré's departure. Berchtold declared quixotically that he believed it unlikely that word of our step would be publicly known before Poincaré left St. Petersburg, but since he was aware that news of Vienna's plans had already reached Rome, speed was of the essence. The Serbian government would be given 48 hours to respond. If it was not accepted in full by the Serbs, the ultimatum would expire early in the evening of Saturday, the 25th of July. What would happen next? The rest of the discussion touched on various aspects of the post-ultimatum scenario. Conrad assured Tisza that sufficient forces would be made available to secure Transylvania against possible Romanian attack. Tisza insisted that Austria-Hungary must declare at the outset that it had no plans of aggrandizement against Serbia and did not intend to annex any of the kingdom's territory. The Hungarian premier was strongly opposed, as at the previous meeting, to any measure that would bring more angry South Slavs into the monarchy. He also feared that the prospect of Austrian annexations would make it impossible for the Russians to back down. This demand triggered some hefty discussion. Berchtold in particular maintained that the territorial reduction of Serbia might, in the aftermath of a conflict, prove to be an indispensable means of neutralizing the threat it posed to Austro-Hungarian security. Tisza stood his ground, and the meeting agreed on a compromise. Vienna would formally announce in due course that the dual monarchy was not waging a war of conquest and had no designs on Serbian territory. However, it would leave open the possibility that other states, notably Bulgaria, might secure areas of territory currently controlled by the Serbs. Neither this nor the other Austrian summit meetings produced anything even remotely resembling what we would today call an exit strategy. Serbia was not a rogue state in an otherwise quiet neighbourhood. Adjacent Albania remained extremely unstable. There was always the possibility that Bulgaria, once engorged with lands from Serbian-controlled Macedonia, would return to its earlier Russophile policy, And how would one balance Bulgarian annexations in Macedonia against the need to mollify Romania with territorial compensations? Would the Ostrophobe Karageorgievich dynasty remain in place? And if not, who or what would replace it? And there were practical questions of a lesser order. Who would take care of the Austrian legations in Belgrade and Cetinje if Austria-Hungary were obliged to break off relations? The Germans, perhaps? All of this remained unclear. And once again, as at the meeting of the 7th of July, the possibility of Russian intervention received only the most perfunctory attention. Conrad's comments on the military situation focused exclusively on Austria's Plan B, a purely Balkan military scenario, rather than on Plan R, which provided for the possibility of a Russian attack on Austrian Galicia. Yet none of the ministers present thought to press Conrad on the question of how he would respond if the Russians did in fact intervene, or to ask him how easy it would be to transition from one deployment scenario to the other. The eyes of the Austrian political elite were still riveted on the quarrel with Belgrade, to the exclusion of broader concerns. Even when news reached Vienna of Poincaré's extraordinary warning to Zapary that Serbia had friends, a message revealing that France and Russia had harmonized their views on how they would respond to an Austrian démarche, Berthold did not consider a change of course. The note and the ultimatum were drafted by Baron Musselin von Gomirje, a relatively junior figure, counselor from 1910 in the sections for Church Policy and East Asia. Musselin was tasked with drafting the ultimatum because he had a reputation as an excellent stylist. He was, as Louis Namier later put it, one of those average, personally honest, well-meaning men whom a dark fate had chosen for pawns in the game that was to result in the greatest disaster of European history. Musselin filed away at his text like a jeweler with a precious stone. The covering note to the ultimatum opened by recalling that Serbia had promised in the aftermath of the Bosnian annexation crisis to get along on a footing of good neighbourliness with Austria-Hungary. Despite this undertaking, the letter went on, the Serbian government had continued to tolerate the existence on its territory of a subversive movement which had sponsored acts of terrorism by a series of outrages and by murders, a somewhat histrionic reference to the dozen or so abortive South Slav terrorist plots that had preceded the assassinations at Sarajevo. Far from attempting to suppress such activity, the letter claimed, the Serbian government had tolerated the criminal machinations of various societies and associations, and tolerated all the manifestations of a nature to inculcate in the Serbian population hatred for the monarchy and its institutions. The preliminary investigation into the plot to slay the Archduke had revealed that it was planned and supplied in Belgrade, and that the passage of the killers into Bosnia had been expedited by officials of the Serbian Frontier Service. The time was therefore over for the attitude of forbearance that the monarchy had hitherto shown in its relations with Serbia. The last part of the letter stipulated that the Belgrade government must post a public notice across the kingdom, the text was provided, repudiating pan-Serbian irredentism. Perhaps the most interesting feature of this text, which provided the raw material for the letter that would be circulated to the other powers when Austria declared war on Belgrade 5 days later, is that it does not assert direct complicity on the part of the Serbian state in the murders at Sarajevo. Instead, it makes the more modest claim that the Serbian authorities had tolerated the organizations and activities that gave rise to the assassinations. This careful wording was in part simply a reflection of what the Austrians knew and did not know. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Vienna had sent Section Councillor Dr. Friedrich von Wiesner to Sarajevo to collate and analyze all the available evidence on the background to the plot. On the 13th of July, after a scrupulous investigation, Wiesner dispatched a report concluding that there was, as yet, no evidence to prove the responsibility or complicity of the Belgrade government. This report would later be cited by those who claimed that Austria, being determined to wage war, had merely used Sarajevo as a pretext. But the situation at the time was more complex, as Wiesner later explained to the American historian Bernadotte Everly Schmidt. His telegram had been widely misunderstood. Personally, Wiesner recalled, he was at the time quite convinced by the evidence secured at the investigation of the moral culpability of the Serbian government for the Sarajevo crime, but as the evidence was not of the kind which a court of law would accept, he had been unwilling to have it used in the formal case against Serbia. He had, he said, made this clear on his return to Vienna. Since the Austrians were determined to make their case as legally tight as possible, there could be no question of alleging direct culpability on the part of the Serbian states in the murders at Sarajevo. There was enough in the evidence relating to the preparation and training of the boys and of their passage across the Serbian border only to confirm the involvement of various subordinate state agencies. In chasing the nebulous structures of the Narodna Odbrana, moreover, the Austrians had missed the much more important Black Hand, whose networks reached deep into the Serbian state. They had not been able to trace the trail to Apis, nor had they been able to nail down the question of Serbian government foreknowledge of the conspiracy, perhaps because Bilinski, embarrassed by his own failure to report to Berchtold his brief conversation with the Serbian ambassador, subsequently kept a lid on the entire episode. Had they possessed fuller knowledge, the Austrians would doubtless have felt even more justified in the measures they planned to undertake. For the moment, the opprobrium of the Friedung trial, which was already being brandished by the Russians and the French as an argument against accepting Vienna's claims, obliged the drafters of the ultimatum to trim their language to what could be proven beyond doubt on the basis of the information that had already emerged from the investigation in Sarajevo. There followed the 10 demands of the ultimatum proper. The first 3 points focused on the suppression of irredentist organs and of the anti-Austrian propaganda they generated. Points 4, 6, and 8 addressed the need to take action against persons implicated in the Sarajevo outrage, including compromised military personnel and frontier officials, and accessories to the plot of the 28th of June who are on Serbian territory. Point 7 was more specific. It demanded the arrest, without delay, of Major Vojo Tankosic and Milan Siganovic. Tankosic was, unbeknown to the Austrians, a Black Hand operative close to Apis. It was he who had recruited the 3 youths who formed the core of the assassination team. Siganovic was known to the Austrians only as a Serbian state employee implicated by the findings of the preliminary investigation at Sarajevo. But he was also, according to the later testimony of Ljuba Jovanovic, a member of the Black Hand, who doubled as an agent working secretly for Pašić. Point 9 requested that Belgrade furnish Vienna with explanations regarding the unjustifiable utterances of high Serbian officials, both in Serbia and abroad, who, notwithstanding their official position, have not hesitated since the outrage of the 28th of June to express themselves in interviews in terms of hostility towards the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. This point referred, among other things, to the interviews given by Balajkovic in St. Petersburg. It also reminds us how deeply Austrian attitudes were affected by Serbian responses to the outrage. Point 10 simply requested official notification, without delay, of the measures undertaken to meet the preceding points. The most controversial points were 5 and 6. Point 5 demanded that the Belgrade government accept the collaboration in Serbia of organs of the imperial and royal government of Austria-Hungary in the suppression of the subversive movement directed against the territorial integrity of the monarchy, and point 6 stated that organs delegated by Austria-Hungary would take part in the investigations relating to accessories in the crime. As usual in Vienna, this text was composed by many hands, but it was Berchtold who had insisted on incorporating a reference to Austrian involvement. The reason is obvious enough. Vienna did not trust the Serbian authorities to press home the investigation without some form of Austrian supervision and verification. And it must be said that nothing the Serbian government did between the 28th of June and the presentation of the ultimatum gave them any reason to think otherwise. This was the demand irreconcilable with Serbian sovereignty that had already been identified in Paris, St. Petersburg, and Belgrade as the prospective trigger for a broader confrontation. One can legitimately ask, of course, whether a state can be made responsible for the actions of private citizens planned on its territory. But framing the issue in terms of Serbia's inviolable sovereignty skewed the picture somewhat. First, there was the question of reciprocity. The Serbian state, or at least the statesmen who directed it, accepted responsibility for the eventual reunion of all Serbs, including those living within the Austro-Hungarian dual monarchy. This implied at best a limited acknowledgement of the empire's sovereign rights within the unredeemed lands of serfdom. Then there was the fact that the Serbian state under Pašić could exercise only very limited control over the irredentist networks. The interpenetration of the conspiratorial networks with the Serbian state and the transnational affiliations of ethnic irredentism made a nonsense of any attempt to understand the friction between Serbia and Austro-Hungary in terms of an interaction between sovereign territorial states. And, of course, the transnational organs and legal framework that today arbitrate in such conflicts and monitor their resolution were not in existence. When Edward Grey saw the full text of the Austrian ultimatum, he described it famously as the most formidable document he had ever seen addressed by one state to another that was independent. In a letter to his wife, Winston Churchill described the note as the most insolent document of its kind ever devised. We do not know what comparators Grey and Churchill had in mind, and the specificity of the historical situation created by the Sarajevo crimes makes comparative judgments difficult. But it would certainly be misleading to think of the Austrian note as an anomalous regression into a barbaric and bygone era before the rise of sovereign states. The Austrian note was a great deal milder, for example, than the ultimatum presented by NATO to Serbia-Yugoslavia in the form of the Rambouillet Agreement drawn up in February and March 1999 to force the Serbs into complying with NATO policy in Kosovo. Its provisions included the following. NATO personnel shall enjoy, together with their vehicles, vessels, aircraft, and equipment, free and unrestricted passage and unimpeded access through the former Republic of Yugoslavia, including associated airspace and territorial waters. This shall include, but not be limited to, the right of bivouac, maneuver, billet, and utilization of any areas or facilities as required for support, training, and operations. Henry Kissinger was doubtless right when he described Rambouillet as a provocation, an excuse to start bombing, whose terms were unacceptable even to the most moderate Serbian. The demands of the Austrian note pale by comparison. Vienna's ultimatum was, to be sure, drawn up on the assumption that the Serbs would probably not accept it. This was not a last-ditch attempt to save the peace between the two neighbours, but an uncompromising statement of the Austrian position. On the other hand, it was not, unlike Rambouillet, a demand for the complete prostration of the Serbian state. Its terms were tightly focused on the threat posed by Serbian irredentism to Austrian security, and even points 5 and 6 reflected concerns about the reliability of Serbian compliance that the drafters had reason to believe were valid. Let us remember that as late as the 16th of July, when the British minister Dayrell Krakenthorpe put it to Slavko Grujic, Secretary-General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Belgrade, that it might be a good idea to launch an independent Serbian investigation of the crimes, Grujic had insisted on the impossibility of adopting any definite measures before learning the findings of the Sarajevo investigation. Once the report was published, Grujic continued, the Serbian government would comply with whatever request for further investigation the circumstances might call for, and which would be compatible with international usage. Should the worst come to the worst, Gruitch added ominously, Serbia would not stand alone. Russia would not remain quiet were Serbia wantonly attacked. These obfuscating formulations suggested that the chances of compliance without coercion to the demands of a hostile neighbour were slim indeed. It was precisely the issues of enforcement and compliance that the Serbian government had addressed in its circular to the powers justifying the attack of the Balkan states on the Ottoman Empire in 1912. The repeated failure of the Ottomans to address the need for reforms in Macedonia, they argued, meant that their refusal to accept any form of foreign participation in such reforms and their promises to apply serious reforms by themselves were greeted throughout the world with a deeply rooted distrust. Whether anyone in Belgrade noticed the parallel in July 1914 is doubtful. Serbia responds. On the morning of the 23rd of July, the Austrian minister Baron Giesel telephoned the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Belgrade to inform them that Vienna would be delivering an important communication for the Serbian Prime Minister that evening. Pašić was away from Belgrade, campaigning for the elections. The finance minister, Lazar Paču, had been appointed to replace him in his absence. On receiving the advance warning of the note, Paču managed to reach Pašić by telephone in Niš. Despite the pleas of the minister, Pašić refused to return to the capital. "Receive Giesel in my place," was his instruction. When Giesel appeared in person at the ministry at 6 p.m., the deadline having been postponed by an hour, he was received by Paču and Gruitch, who had been asked to attend the meeting because the finance minister did not speak French. Giesel handed to Paču the ultimatum, a two-page annex and a covering note addressed to Paču as acting prime minister, and informed him that the time limit for a reply was exactly 48 hours. When that deadline expired, if there were an unsatisfactory reply or none at all, Giesel would break off diplomatic relations and return to Vienna with the entire legation staff. Without opening the dossier, Paču answered that as the elections were in full swing and many ministers were away from Belgrade, it might be physically impossible to assemble the responsible office holders in time to deliver a decision. Giesel replied that, in the age of railways and telegraphs, and in a country of this size, the return of the ministers could only be a matter of a few hours. In any case, he added, this was an internal matter for the Serbian government, on which he, Giesel, need take no view. Giesel's telegram dispatch to Vienna closes with the words, there was no further discussion. But in post-war conversations with the Italian historian Luigi Albertini, the former Austrian minister recalled that Paču hesitated, saying he was unable to accept the note. Giesel responded that in that case he would place it on the table and Paču could do what he liked with it. As soon as Giesel left, Paču gathered the Serbian ministers still present in the capital, and they went through the text together. Paču in particular was shocked because he had been expecting, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that the Germans would ultimately hold Vienna back from any step that might also drag her, Germany, into war. For a time the men studied the note in deathly silence, because no one ventured to be the first to express his thoughts. The first to speak was the Minister of Education, Ljuba Jovanovic, who paced the room back and forth several times and then declared, "We have no other choice but to fight it out." A curious interlude followed. In view of the extreme importance of the note, it was clear to all present that Pašić must return immediately to Belgrade. Pašić had spent the morning campaigning in Niš in southern Serbia for the elections of the 14th of August. After giving a speech, the Prime Minister seemed suddenly to lose interest in the campaign. "It would be a good thing if we were to take a little rest," he told Sajinovic, the political director of the foreign ministry, who was travelling with him. "What do you think of going off to Salonika, that is, Thessaloniki, annexed to Greece by the Treaty of Bucharest in 1913, where we could stay 2 or 3 days incognito?" While Pašić and the political director waited for the Prime Minister's special coach to be coupled onto the train to Thessaloniki, Pashich was informed by a station attendant that there was an urgent telephone call from Belgrade. It was Lazar Pachu, begging him to return to the capital. Pashich had no intention of hurrying back. "I told Lazar that when I get back to Belgrade, we shall give the answer." Lazar told me, from what he had heard, that it was to be no ordinary note. But I stood firmly by my reply. Sure enough, he and Sayinovich went to take their seats in the train to Thessaloniki. Only when the train reached Leskovac, nearly 50